United Lutheran Seminary presents the Seminary Explores podcast, conversations on faith, art, people, politics, theology, life, and more, with voices from around the corner and around the globe. Welcome to the Seminary Explores. I'm Katie Giebenhain. My guest is West Virginia Poet Laureate Mark Harshman. Mark holds degrees from Bethany College, Yale Divinity School, and the University of Pittsburgh. He is the 2019 winner of the Allen Ginsberg Poetry Award. His collection, Woman in Red Anorak, won the Blue Lynx Prize, and his collection, Believe What You Can, was the Appalachian Book of the Year. A writer and teacher, Mark has published 14 children's books, the most recent of which is Falling Water, co-written with Anna Smucker about architect Frank Lloyd Wright's iconic house. He's here between gigs at Hood College in Frederick and the Ragged Edge Coffee House in Gettysburg. Mark, welcome to the Seminary Explores.
I'm so happy to be here, Katie. It's just a real treat.
Well, since you are in Pennsylvania, how about if we start with a question about the Falling Water book and how you wrote this for children, children's book about this house. Yeah.
Well, Anna Smucker and I have been friends ever since we published our first books in a small state like West Virginia. We were bound to find each other publishing our first book on the national stage in 1989. And we always read each other's children's manuscripts. And sometime many years ago, we discovered we had this shared passion for Frank Lloyd Wright's Falling Water House. And we said, we should write a children's book. And it was that simple. We put our heads together. Anna's really great on research. And as a poet, perhaps I've got a little bit of a flair for language. So we tried to bring both of our skills together. And I think it worked out really well. It was an Amazon Book of the Month. And it's gotten all kinds of rave reviews and more than we could have ever asked. And Wynn Fahm, the illustrator, is one of America's finest. And when our editor told us at Roaring Brook Macmillan that this would be the woman doing the pictures, we were very, very happy.
Well, and when I look at it, just the design is such that I think if you're like reading it to a child at bedtime, for example, it's pleasure for adults and children, right? Not only the story, but the design, and you really feel the sensibility of Frank Lloyd Wright really comes through.
Yes, I think certainly with Fahm's illustrations that happened, and thank you. Hopefully the text does that as well. I often think that the best children's books please us all, whether one's an adult or whether one's a child. So that's been the case for me. It was, I taught fifth and sixth grade for many years, and I love trying to, I loved using children's picture books in my teaching. The nonfiction books were especially useful in everything from science to social studies. I remember that, at least in West Virginia, sixth grade was when you taught world history, and that included the 20th century. And I found it absolutely essential that I address the Holocaust. And yet at the same time with children, I didn't feel comfortable using the more ghastly of the photographs that create part of the record. And I found a couple of absolutely wonderful children's picture books that addressed that tragedy with both a honesty and gravitas without being too distressing for a young person. The book I think of most is a little, almost wordless, not quite, a picture book called Rose Blanche by the Italian artist and writer Roberto Innocente. And I still treasure those moments with my students being able to teach that way. And it was a picture book that made it possible.
So I have a poetry question for you. So you've been writing for a very long time, writing and reading. What still dazzles you about poetry as a reader and as a writer?
I could start talking now, and I wouldn't let you ask another question, Katie. I mean, it's simply the truth. At least for me, I can still read a poem and it just takes my breath away, stops me dead, makes me re-see myself, re-see the world. gives me a kind of deep-seated pleasure, or it makes me weep. It really does. I mean, I'm in the land of cliches here, but it really puts me in that deeper place. I know I'm more inclined now than when I was younger. When I read a great poem, I also want to share it. So I'm immediately at the keyboard or on to the phone, calling up a friend saying, listen to this, hear this, or shouting across the kitchen to my wife, listen to this. And that's a pleasure as well, the sharing.
The sharing and the recommending, right?
Yes.
Could you say something about this? You have a really interesting mentor from years ago from a bookshop. And, you know, mentors are so important. Could you say something about that person?
Yeah, it's a long story, so we may want to cut it.
An abridged, yeah.
Yes. And I had wonderful teachers, don't get me wrong, starting as early as grade school and high school, but people who made a real difference in my life. My hat is always off to teachers far and wide. But when I was at Yale, at Divinity School, I did take the train into the city with some frequency, just to do bookshops, jazz, you know, the whole nine yards with New York City. And I remember one weekend, my wife and I were in the city. It must have been maybe right at the new year. And we had done bookshops, and we'd gone to the Gotham Bookmark, one of the real landmark bookstores in America, and now gone, in the Diamond District it was. And made our purchases, and as we were checking out, the young man or woman checking us out said, oh, I see from these books, I'd bought some the usual beat books of poems and some Black Mountain books, and he said, you might like this, and he gave us an invitation to a party on Valentine's Day weekend to celebrate the Jargon Society's 25th anniversary of publishing. That's Jonathan Williams, Black Mountain School. And so I thought, what a lark. So we came back in a few weeks, and we went upstairs to the Gotham Bookmart and Gotham Bookstore, and walked in, and there was Allen Ginsberg in one corner, and there was Creeley, and all these iconic figures from the 50s and 60s and beat Black Mountain literature. And I don't remember much about the evening, except that we were kind of quiet and stood around and stared. But there was a keepsake catalog for the Jargon Society, listing every title they'd ever published. And then on the back of the booklet, it listed the best places to find their books. And there were two stores in London, the Gotham in New York, City Lights in San Francisco. And then it said, and still, the best place to find all out-of-print titles is the Asphodel Bookshop, Ravenna Road, Burton, Ohio. My wife and I looked at each other, and we sort of laughed because we knew the Midwest. My wife was just in that part of the world, and we said, well, that's just a little town out in the middle of the cornfields. Mm-hmm. And so that summer, we called up the Asphodel Bookshop, and we said, are you open? And the man said, well, I live here. I guess we are. How do you find it? He said, look for Tessa's Beauty Salon. That's me. He thought, what in the hell have we stumbled into? So we drove through the cornfields, and it was outside of Burton, Ohio, and just a little country place next door to a farm. And it was this converted garage.
Okay.
And we walked in, and it was like a treasure house. There were all these amazing just shelves lined with all these books of poetry and obscure titles, brand new titles, magazines from all across the Commonwealth countries, original sheet music by Debussy and Eric Satie and Charles Ives, first editions by Joyce and Faulkner and Virginia Woolf, and on and on. All these magazines I'd heard of that were being printed in the UK and Australia, but I'd never seen. And that was fascinating. And but more important was the man himself, who became rather an arbiter of my tastes. I would try to buy a book. He said, you don't want that. The man said, this is making money. And he wouldn't let me pay him money for books. He said, take that. And he had a chest-high stack of broadsides that were just gorgeous hand-print, hand-pressed, letter-pressed books. Beautiful. Anyway, his name was Jim Lowell. And his most famous claim to fame is that the police closed down his bookshop when it was in downtown Cleveland. He had moved out to the country because he carried the Marijuana Review, and which was nothing really salacious, but in that era it was seen that way. And Jim himself was very, he wasn't a hippie. He was 15, 20 years older than I am, very, always coat and tie, very proper gentleman. But there's a famous photograph of Allen Ginsberg standing beside Jim because they'd had a rally or fundraiser, something to support the Asphodel Bookshop when they tried to close it in Cleveland. But he became a very good friend, he and his wife. And he introduced me to especially a group of, post-beat writers in the UK, mm-hmm. who became not only influences, but became very good friends. Mm-hmm. Gail Turnbull, I still think, is one of the finest overlooked poets in the US, a Scottish poet. And John Freeman, who's one of my very best friends, just won the Welsh Book of the Year for poetry a couple years ago. And I met them all through Jim. Mm. Yeah, so long story.
Excellent.
Cut as you will, Katie.
So I'm interested in what kind of advice you might have for seminary or divinity school students, because pastors are by default writers. And I'm thinking about one of the epigraphs that you've got in your poetry collection, Believe What You Can. This is from Rebecca Solnit, A Field Guide to Getting Lost. Here's the quote. Leave the door open for the unknown, the door into the dark. That's where the most important things come from, where you yourself came from, and where you will go. And I'll tell you, when I read this, I hear the echo of Leonard Cohen and about the crack where the light comes through, right? Ring the bells that still can ring. Forget your perfect everything.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
And there's a certain resonance here, and I'm just wondering what's something that you might have to say about writers today who are also engaged in writing as pastors.
Yes. Yeah. It's the hardest job in the world. I don't know how men and women do this, pastor their flocks, as it were. Say that. That said, I think that epigraph you read just now from Rebecca Solnit is so incredibly important, because if you don't embrace the doubt, if you don't embrace, acknowledge the mystery, I don't know how you're ever going to lead a flock. Because this side of the veil, we don't know. I mean, that's one of the givens. That's what faith is about, is that you reach, even though you don't know exactly where, but you try to reach towards what's true and good. It's not just the pastoral profession, but it does disturb me that in our contemporary lives, and we've been bemoaning our busyness ever since I was a young man, but it has gotten even crazier.
True.
And I only wish poets as well as pastors kept more room for the mystery, more room for the silence, acknowledged it with a greater, louder public admission that we don't know all. I'm tempted to preach myself. I am Well, I'll say it. I am struck sometimes how little of a spiritual life many of my friends, and I mean dear friends and colleagues, how little of a spiritual life they have because they've become pastors and ministers. Mm-hmm. And I think how tragically ironic that is, because they're so busy being good, rightfully good, and huge sacrifices of their own personal time. I get all that. Nonetheless, I see from the outside that they're not able to take time for sustained silence, which seems to me is at the heart of all prayer. Centering prayer, some people call it, a Zen sit in another tradition. For Christians, certainly all the post-Thomas Merton influences through Father Keating and Father Richard Rohr and James Finley and Cynthia Bourgeau and on I could go. And I think that we need fed by that. And that things like the arts can feed pastoral work in a deep way. It's what feeds me as I get older. I mean, young people will ask me, you know, what should I do? And I'd say, well, immerse yourself in the life of the arts. Worry less about publishing. Worry more about, you know, listening to good music, reading good poetry, going to the museum when you're in the city, so on. I'm rambling, sorry.
Healthy advice.
That touched a nerve, but I mean, there's so many great examples in the arts of that convert me, that return me to a better path. As we talked earlier, you know, what is it about poetry that still gets to me? And I mean, that's the religious right there. What stops our breath? What takes our breaths away? That's what we should be feeding each other. Rilke, I mean, that I remember that was a poet I was required to read in divinity school, and I think how wise, how good, how smart that was. I only wish there had been more.
Well, how about if you read us a poem? Could you read us one of yours?
Sure. This is a poem. The only thing that I think needs explained is that there was an island in the Second World War in the Pacific Theater called Peleliu, and across its ground, probably there was more blood shed per square inch than anywhere else during that awful war. Restless. In spectacular sunlight, the old woman's fingers never stop. Knit and purl, knit and purl. They work an invisible and resilient yarn. I wonder what she is making, or rather when it was and where. Perhaps it was that elm-shaded porch in Apple Valley during the war, where letters were read and hours spent matching headlines, foreign names, to that atlas next to the Bible in which already two new death dates were recorded that year. Brother Oliver, 36, son Richard, 19, Oliver in the North Atlantic, Richard on an island in the Pacific, Peleliu, less than a fraction the size of her small county in rural Ohio. Such size puzzled her, seemed unfair, unseemly. Maybe that's why she was so good with her hands, rarely dropping a stitch, producing perfect sweaters and scarves and afghans. But I think now it's nothing so elaborate as a sweater, only a pair of socks, practical, simple, what the boys needed. And maybe her hands are simply searching another pattern, that one we all reach for, wishing to bring the dead back from dying, to bring them back who've gone away from us, away from the touch of hands that once could mend anything if there was enough yarn, enough light, enough time.
Oh, thank you. Oh, that's lovely.
Thanks.
That goes across time, doesn't it?
I hope.
It does. It certainly does. And actually, my final question for you is related to our rural-urban sort of, I call it misunderstandings right now in the United States. So we're polarized in a lot of ways. And one of them is the way that we sort of perceive each other, the way that geography has prevented us from seeing our neighbor as our neighbor, right? The way that, and because you are the Poet Laureate of West Virginia, I think you do have some, I mean, not only from your own life, from your experiences, but also because this is the state that you live in. I was wondering if as a poet and as a resident of this area, if you have any insights or comments about this, you know, about where we find ourselves.
That's a tough one, Katie. I do, and I am a very political person, and yet I also know that 9 times out of 10, when I bring politics into my own, into the poetry itself, I simply produce a rant. And nobody wants to hear someone yelling or slamming their fists.
Right, right.
What I do think converts, back to that word, what I do think converts is that is poetry at its best, regardless of its topic. Poetry reminds us that there's something deeper, more profoundly good about each of us that that goes beyond political boundaries, and that's where we must touch. Little moments of ecstasy. I just heard somebody talking on NPR last evening as I came out of doing my reading last night, but it seems silly, but there was a certain amount of truth. Everybody's so happy that the Nationals won in the Washington area. Forgive me, Houston friends. But they were talking about how, you know, for a moment, the political boundaries are down and that people can talk. And I like to think that, you know, good art, good poetry also can bring those boundaries down. And even if it's only for the moment of the poem, that's an important moment. That's a precious moment. And perhaps what I do as a poet, what I do as the Poet Laureate for the state of West Virginia is that every time I'm reading with an audience, I'm at least letting that come down for a moment so that we can all see each other again, just as the people we are. So I do try to come at things at an come at them slant, as we say, and sometimes you can get away with it. You can cut things. I have a poem which I find very ironic. There's a poem in the Believe What You Can book called F***ed. It's not there's very little sexual connotation, and it's just the poem at the end of the day is my trying to understand that person who is so different than me politically. That is really what the poem is about, which is a very hard thing for us to do, I think, right now, is to understand that person who is so other than we are, especially in political ways. And that's also one of our duties. I mean, I thought at that moment I wasn't ranting so much. That I was just trying to understand, and poetry is my vehicle for understanding.
Well, on this, any way that we can get a conversation going, I mean, the Nationals is a fantastic example of what sports can do, what art can do, to remind us of that.
Right.
Well, thank you so much for your time and for your conversation.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to The Seminary Explores. I'm Katie Giebenhain. My guest has been West Virginia Poet Laureate Mark Harshman. Visit his website at markharshman.com. That's MarkHarshman. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Katie. It's been a pleasure.
You have been listening to The Seminary Explores, a production of United Lutheran Seminary with campuses in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, and Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. We invite you to visit our website at unitedlutheranseminary.edu. Opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of United Lutheran Seminary or the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America.